What's up, y'all? Summer's got a different tempo. Everything's a little looser, brighter. One plan turns into another. You hear something, you stay a little longer. Next thing you know, you're somewhere you didn't plan to be. It's those in-between moments. That's where the ideas hit. Conversations stretch out, little memories sneak up on you. And sometimes, it's just about what's in your hand. That color, that chill. The new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks. Guava and passion fruit flavors with mango pineapple flavored pearls. Yeah, that feels like summer before you even taste it. Funny how one small stop becomes the best part of the day. Start your summer rhythm with Starbucks. Try the new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. I have to say, I'm genuinely super excited to be joined by Mr. Gilbert King today. Gilbert, I have, because of this show, I listen to true crime podcasts all week, every week to prep for these interviews. And I enjoy most of them, but yours is the first I've had in a long time where I listened to the first episode and just couldn't stop and binge the entire thing. I put off all sorts of work I was supposed to be doing so that I could listen to your podcast. Well, amazing job on Bone Valley.
That's really nice of you, Bob. I don't meet too many people who totally binge it that way, so good for you.
Oh, I couldn't stop. And of course, we're joined by Erica. Are you back home, Erica? That looks like a young person closet.
Yes, I am back in this tiny closet.
I know the closet well.
Yeah. We interviewed Jason a couple weeks ago, and he also was in a closet. I felt left out being the only
one. Yeah, that's how I got my idea. Yeah. That's pretty funny.
So Gilbert, before we start talking about this podcast, I want to talk a little bit about you. So you live in New York City now. Are you from New York?
Pretty much. I've been here for like the last 35 years. I'm from upstate New York, so I consider myself a New Yorker now.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. I like to consider myself a New Yorker after I spent a couple days there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I understand that.
It's one of my favorite places to visit. Yeah. And you, before the podcast, you've had quite a career. You've won a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah. I mean, mostly I do writing. I write books. So I'm not even like a journalist or a newspaper writer. I've mostly been doing books for like the last 20 years. And it's kind of interesting how this started, because I went down to do this story on Leo Schofield's case, thinking maybe I'll just write like a long feature or something like that. And I ended up just saying, you know what? Everybody's still alive. I'm kind of not used to that. I'm used to dealing with like documents and cases from the 1940s where everybody's dead. Which I don't mind. It's actually less complicated in a lot of ways. But I mostly consider myself a narrative nonfiction writer who's just sort of like stumbled into the world of podcasting.
Yeah. Well, and that's so many people nowadays. And those are becoming like the most popular podcast, seems like, people who come from a print background.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a sort of structural form of storytelling that we're used to. So it's not just the reporting and the investigation, which I love. It's actually the most fun part for me. There's a lot of times I finish like my investigations for the books that I write, and I'm like, oh, now I got to write this thing. I just feel like I did all the work already. I know the story.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, you actually have to write it. And it's just kind of the same way with podcasting. But I think it really does help when you come from the discipline of writing. You understand transitions and structure and my podcast is probably a little less conversational than ones that you're used to listening to, but just because I like to have everything written out on the page.
Yeah. But, you know, you captured some of those great moments, though, between you. Kelsey, is Kelsey
yeah,
the one that was
Kelsey,
traveling
right.
with you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there are some amazing moments that you got. Were you guys, and I was going to ask you how you captured, were you just rolling all the time?
Yeah.
Because there's some really organic moments where you guys are like, what the fuck is going
exactly.
on
here? Exactly. I was just going to say, I was like, I just finished episode 4 on my way home like a few minutes ago. And that's the episode that ends with, I think it's Kelsey saying, who the fuck is Jeremy Scott?
Right, right.
That was, and it's, so it's a perfect ending to the episode.
Yeah, and that was sort of like our stepping off point, because, you know, talking about like narrative structure, like, you know, Jeremy Scott's a big part of this story. And I had originally envisioned like some kind of parallel narrative where you see a little bit of both people and then ultimately merge. I think that would have worked really well in a book. It doesn't work in a podcast so much because you don't want to give away too much. So there's different challenges that come up with making a podcast. But in terms of like that kind of spontaneous stuff, we were constantly rolling our tape because we didn't know what we were doing. So we were just told, just leave it on. And anytime you're planning something or thinking of something. So we have a lot of garbage and stuff that would never see the air. But then I think our producers got a hold of it and they kind of liked some of the things that we were saying, trying to figure things out. And so this is a really good moment. It sort of defines who you guys are in a very casual way. And it's got all your salty language in there. So we love it.
Yeah, right. Everybody loves salty language in a podcast.
Yeah, we have no choice.
Yeah. But man, that's such a tough job. So I have a very small operation I do this show and I do another show called Truth and Justice, which is an investigative series, long form. And I do that, but I produce stuff myself. And I always have these great ideas of we're going to roll tape the whole time. And there's all these great conversations. And then I get home and I'm like, I have 20 hours to sort through to figure out where these cool moments were. So I'm just going to skip it because I got the episode's due in 2 days.
It's really exhausting. I know what you mean. I don't even like to go back and listen to it. I'm like, it happened. I don't want to hear it anymore. You know, but yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think I've told the story in here before, but there was one time my old producer and editor, Mike, and I we were out on the road working on a case out in Illinois somewhere. And we had one of those like organic conversations where I was like, oh, that would be really cool. Kind of sets the scene. There are all these windmills, you know, in Southern Illinois. And we were just chatting about those. And I realized, oh, shit, the recorder's dead. And then I had this brilliant idea. We'll just recreate the conversation for two guys who aren't actors.
Yeah.
And it was the most cringy, horrible thing.
I know.
Gee, Bob, what are all these windmills for? What are you guys? Terrible.
That's so funny you say that, because I remember I didn't really know podcasts that well. Kelsey knew them a little bit more than I did. And I remember just one time we were at the gas station, you know, close to where the Michelle's Mazda was found. And I was trying to like, let's go there and let's see it. And again, we didn't know what we were doing. And I started talking and Kelsey just looking at me. She's like, you're using like a newscaster's voice. This is not a news show. And I was just talking the wrong way. We're here at the scene of, you know, like, what the hell is that? Nobody told me how to do this. I'm just...
No, well, your producers did a fantastic job of pulling out those very real moments.
That's for sure.
Yeah. Because it's your podcast, the way you produce it is like the way that I always envision. It's like the perfect way that I would love to create a podcast, listen to a podcast. So I was just captivated by the storytelling mixed in with the interviews. You know, the sound design's amazing, and then cut in with the organic, real conversation. It's for your first jump into the podcasting space, you really knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, and I will just say that we did a really nice job, Kelsey and I, on reporting all of this. But in terms of podcasting and how it would sound like. I looked at one of my old scripts, my first script before we even started working with, I started to write it out and I can't even look at it now. It's so terrible and so stilted. And it really took like our producer, Kara Kornhaber and Britt Spangler, who came in, she was the sound designer. And the way these two just worked it out and worked out a flow, like it was just something that was way beyond Kelsey and I. So it was really our team that really put this together and made it sound the way it sounds. We had the reporting and the story, but I credit all of them for just making it sound good, because I would have been clueless without them.
They did an incredible job. And so speaking of the team behind you, we had Jason on. Is it going to be is it going to air 2 weeks before this one, Erica?
I think so, yes.
Okay. So I told Jason that I was going to get your version of how did you go from getting the story to connecting with Jason and Lava for Good podcast?
You know, I don't know what his story is, but I'll tell you what I remember of mine. You know, we had a couple false starts. We were moving around trying to get this thing placed, and it wasn't really working out for us. But we kept on reporting, kept on going with the story, and ultimately, I had known who Jason was. We were going to do an event together a couple years earlier, and we talked on the phone. And I've been listening to his podcast, and I remember just saying, "Jason, you've done all these amazing interviews with the exonerated. You need a narrative of a guy who's not been exonerated yet." And honestly, it was like the easiest thing I've ever dealt with. He's like, "Yeah, I'll put you in touch with my people. Let's get this going." And it was just like that happened that fast. And I was just amazed by it. And it really was, for us, the perfect team, because, we believed in their mission. They believed in the story that we were trying to tell. They put together this beautiful team for us, and we got really lucky. So I don't know if that matches Jason's version, but that's how I remember it.
That's pretty close.
Okay.
He gives it, of course, throws a lot more credit your way, but I know Jason well enough to know that when he heard an opportunity to tell a story that needed to be told, he made the decision to make sure it got done.
Yeah, he really walks the walk. He's out there and he's just doing so much in this space. He's somebody I really deeply admire, and I was just so glad we ended up working together.
Yeah, that's great. So now, by the time you got to him, you had already decided to make this into a podcast?
Yeah, we pivoted fairly early in the research. So as we were researching, we went in with a crappy Zoom recorder on our very first interview with Leo because we didn't think we were doing a podcast. And it's kind of amazing how much of that stuff we ended up using in the podcast from that very first interview, because it's like when we first met, we got 3 hours with him. And even though it was done on this junky tape, somehow Britt was able to save it. It sounded good. Not as good as when we got better equipment and learned how to do this. But the first, our first interview was just so raw and so interesting. And that's when we started to really pivot. We came out of there saying, Leo's a great storyteller. Kelsey was listening to a lot of podcasts. I was starting to listen to him too. And I said, everyone's alive and they're willing to talk to us. We should really just make this a podcast. And it was a challenge, but it was one that we were up for at the time.
Lots of places can accidentally expose you to identity theft. Doctor's offices, online retailers, insurance companies, the list goes on. Thankfully, LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. LifeLock keeps an eye on your personal information, credit applications, finances, and more. And if they find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, they alert you right away. All through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Even better, alerts are automatically activated the moment you become a LifeLock member. No extra work on your part. Get the alerts that could make all the difference. Don't wait. Join LifeLock now. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 30% your first year. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart for 30% off. Terms apply.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Siempre quiero que mi carro dure más y corra suave, sin estrés, sin rollos. Por eso uso Seafoam Motor Treatment. Es bien fácil de usar. Lo echas en el tanque de gasolina y listo. Sin herramientas, sin esperar. Seafoam ayuda a que el motor funcione más suave y dure más tiempo. Y sirve para lo que manejes. Carro, troca, tractor, gasolina o diésel. ¿Tiene motor? Seafoam te respalda. Millones de conductores lo usan todos los días para mantener su motor fuerte. Agarra tu lata hoy en tu tienda de autopartes favorita. Seafoam. Échalo y enciende el poder.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
One thing that I've struggled with from time to time in doing these stories like this one, dealing with people that are still in prison that have been wrongfully incarcerated, Have you struggled at all with making emotional connections or friendships with Leo and then try? When I first started doing it, I was like, whatever, you know, Ed Eights was the first big case that I did. And it was like, you know, we've become friends. He's my friend. And then I felt like it affects my journalistic integrity, but I'm not a journalist either. But I've kind of, you know, I play one on the radio, but you know, do you ever struggle with that or are you able to kind of keep those boundaries where they need to be?
You know, I do think about it all the time because it's something that's kind of new to me. Again, like I've done some journalism. I use journalism when I write books, but I'm not like a trained journalist. And so, you know, I think one of the things is once you get involved with people, you start, you know, becoming close to them and attached to them. And like, you know, mm-hmm. I want to see them get, you know, post-conviction relief. If you start believing in the story and believing in Leo's innocence, like, I don't want to see him sit in prison. Like, I how can I not? I know his wife. I know his child. I know all the people around him now. Everyone believes in their innocence. I believe in his innocence. So yeah, I do struggle with it. But, you know, on the other hand, I think there's some limitations to what journalism can really do. I think, you know, we use journalism to report on these stories. But once you have it all together, you know, you have a story to tell. And I feel like the one thing I really wanted to do with this story was not really report it in a straight out journalism story, but use more of a narrative nonfiction style where it's mm-hmm. very authoritative. You know, like I've done a lot of the work of a lot of the research, so I didn't want to be puzzling that out on the air so that what do you think we should do with this clue and maybe this? And mm-hmm. I kind of want to avoid all that kind of making of the sausage kind of thing and just do a more authoritative narrative vision that goes all the way through. So it's a little bit different, but I feel like it saved us a lot of time and enabled us to be just tighter with our storytelling so that we didn't have to explain a lot. You could sort of just say, all right, trust him. He read the appeal. This is what the appeal said. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have to get into it for 10 minutes. And so there's a lot of structuring that I think that was sort of more in common with, you know, narrative nonfiction or even like an audiobook than it was a straight up true crime podcast.
Yeah, and that's definitely the feeling that you get from it. It was just, there's so many similarities that you particularly were talking about kind of the feelings you were feeling when you're realizing that when at the end of the interview, you get to go home and you get to go, you know, you have all these freedoms and you're realizing, I remember that with Ed the first time I visited a prisoner and we just had this great 2-hour long conversation. And then, you know, I watched him walk back into the cage and mm-hmm. I was leaving and the lawyer that was with me, we were figuring out where to go for lunch. And it just all of a sudden hits you like, mm-hmm. oh,
yeah,
he doesn't get to do that ever. Like to decide when to eat, much less what to eat.
Yeah. I've had exactly those same moments where I just like thinking like, you know, because in a way when you're an inmate, you know, everything is decided for you. There's nothing unexpected. Like it's 5 a.m. This is your count. This is, you know, all of these things that are structured and almost like it's sort of like they're treated a little bit like children with the scheduling. And, and that's part of it. Just, you know, when you talk to Leo and you see how thoughtful and really well-spoken and articulate and intelligent and everything like that. And then you realize, oh, this guy is going to be locked up now. It just really sort of hits you in a really strange way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think you can describe it unless you experience it. And so for me listening to you, is like, it's almost like, someone else that understands what that's like to walk away and just for that to just hit you like a ton of bricks in the face.
Yeah.
In a way that makes sense logically, but for some reason, at least for me, I never saw it coming until it happened.
Right.
And then it was it's just crippling.
Yeah.
When you feel it.
I feel it too. And I you know, it's like one of the things, like after a while, like Leo and I started hugging. And, you know, it's like it became like a much closer, you know, he's putting all his hope on, you know, us with this story. Mm-hmm. It's a strange responsibility to have. But, you know, like I feel it, too. I mean, the guy, every time I talk to him on the phone, he makes me cry. And, you know, it's just like because I'm in the moment and I know what it's like I don't know what it's like to be where he is, but I know what it's like to be talking to somebody. And knowing that, you know, I'm going to go off and go have a dinner somewhere and he's just going to be locked in a cage. And that part just kills me every time, especially when he says something profound, which he always does.
Yeah. Well, and you just touched on something else, too. Another thing that people don't realize or expect is the response. For me, like I didn't realize until I got into it too deep to realize the responsibility that comes with hope. that, you know, and I've had that time and time again through 12 seasons of Truth and Justice, where those people that are incarcerated, they put so much hope that your story is going to be the thing to finally right this wrong. And it's a burden you wear everywhere you go.
Yeah, that's been another thing that I think if you would have told me about it earlier, it would make it, you know, I would love to have known some of these things, because you're in it for life with these people.
Yeah.
Even if you get them out, you know, like even if something happens, a miracle that you can actually get some relief and they're out of prison, you know, when you start one of these stories, you're in it for life. And that was what was sort of new to me. And I had to be ready for that, because, you know, you just cannot abandon people, and they have thoughts and concerns. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, I don't know if I should do this interview. Should I say, you know, should I talk about things that are frustrating me? And like, I, you know, these are really personal decisions, and I don't know, it's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And it weighs for me, especially, really heavy on, you know, I've still got guys, you know, we've been lucky enough to have a few of the guys that we've worked with have gotten out, but then there's a few that are still in, and I talk to them occasionally, and it's tough. Hope's is a dangerous thing sometimes, mm-hmm. because a lot of times I think that the people that are in those situations, they're able to, at least the way I see it, they're able to cope because they've gone through this process, the stages of grief, and get to a point where they almost have to abandon hope in order to live whatever life they're going to have in there. Then you come in and introduce hope again, and it's like, it takes away all of that coping that they've done. It almost reverses it. And it's a really great thing and a really scary thing all at the same time.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you say that, because like one of the things that really hit me as I was just listening to you talk was that we come to Leo, obviously, because we want to know his story, and we're going to ask him to recount like the worst moments of his life when he was 21 years old, right? Mm. Searching
right.
for Michelle, can't find her anywhere, ultimately finding her, the depression of that follows, and then like getting arrested for this and being convicted for her murder. And, you know, one time he reminded me, you know, just Gilbert, pick, you know, you've gone on to write books, you have this life that you've, you know, you're living in a big city, you're free. You know, imagine if someone at the age of 21, who you were at the age of 21, that's all anybody wanted to talk to you about, is that part of your life when you're 21. I was like, I wouldn't even want that. And I, you know, I didn't get
right.
convicted of anything, but like if you went back to my, you know, it's really adolescence, and you go back to that time and say, we're going to just talk about who you were as that in the worst moment of your life. Like, I wouldn't want that. And he said, that's what my life is like. It's just all defined by this case. And, you know, it's exhausting for him to sit down with us for 3 hours, talk about all his hopes and dreams being, you know, dashed in this horrible moment. And then, okay, we're going to take our tape. Good luck, Leo. And, you know, he goes back to his cell and he lives with that for days, and it takes him to a very dark place. And that's the thing that, you know, I've had to learn to understand, because it didn't quite, you know, really occur to me in the moment.
Yeah. Is this the first story that you've done that involved somebody's, and I touched on it earlier, but I want to mention it again. 2012, the book that you won the Pulitzer Prize for is called Devil in the Grove, about four young Black boys that were convicted of raping a white woman in Florida. And by saying that, that was from 1949.
Right.
But I answered my own question with that. So it was a wrongful conviction story, but you didn't have quite the access to everybody then, because the story was from the 40s.
Yeah, right. So by the time I started, all four of the defendants were dead already. So I did have some people to interview. There was one lawyer that was there. Also, the alleged victim in the case was still around, because she was 17 at the time. She decided not to talk to me, and her words to me were, let sleeping dogs lie. She didn't want to revisit this, you know, which I thought was really unfortunate, because I actually had a lot more sympathy than for her, because I didn't think, you know, a 17-year-old was responsible for this. This was really the men in her life, including the sheriff and the prosecutor, who sort of took that story from them. So, yeah, I didn't really have a lot of experience dealing with the wrongly convicted, and researching, finding, you know, falsely imprisoned men, that kind of thing, because everybody was dead at the time. But I did have experience with the cases. I understood Florida justice. So that helped. But
yeah.
You know.
Well, before we move into the story and this actual case, because I want to break that down. And I told everybody in Jason's episode, which is going to air 2 weeks before yours, you better binge it after Jason's, because I'm going to try to get some spoilers to talk about some things that'll be spoilers in this one. Real quick before we get into that, I just want to point out some great journalistic work that I've seen here. In my notes from Erica, it does say here, quote, "I'm pretty sure he has a dog." That's some of the fabulous investigative work.
Journalism, but, coming over.
Yeah. Here, yep. Erica can't. So do you or do you not have a dog?
I do have a dog. I have a dog named Maisie, who's five, almost 6 years old now. And so interestingly, when I started doing this, I ended up moving down to Florida because I was about to start a fellowship in the fall at the New York Public Library. And so I knew I had like 4 months. I said, you know what? I'm just going to, who wants to be in Florida in the summer? I don't, but this is the only time I have to do it. I'm going to start this case. And so I moved down there and just took my dog and basically just rented a house down there. And then Kelsey met me down there and we worked on the case all together with this dog there. So that became our family pet.
So there you go. So she's a mascot. For
yeah,
the,
pretty much. For the story. Pretty much. Yeah.
All right. So tell us about this story. This is all about the murder of Michelle Schofield and what I believe to be, and I think you too, the wrongful conviction of her husband, Leo. So tell us about the case and whatever you're comfortable sharing about the process and the things that you uncovered through the podcast.
Yeah, it's one of these strange cases. Like I was doing a book talk for Devil in the Grove in the summer of 2018. So like, you know, 4 years ago, a little more than 4 years ago. And when I got done, I was talking about my book. This judge came up to me. It was a judicial conference. And he handed me this card. And on the back of his card, he wrote Leo Schofield and his prison number and said, "Not just wrongfully convicted. He's an innocent man." And I remember I went out to dinner with some public defenders. And I passed this around. I said, "Hey, you know, a judge just handed me this at a conference. What do you think of this?" And they were all the same reaction. They were all like, "A judge gave you this? Are you kidding me? He wrote this? They're not supposed to talk about, you know, active cases." And then it got passed around and there was one judge from Polk County or one public defender from Polk County. And he looked at it and he said, "I know this case. You should call him." And that kind of tipped me off. Like something's going on with this case. I'd never heard of it before. So when I got back to New York, I started, called Judge Cup, Judge Scott Cup. And, you know, I said, "Hey, you gave me your card and I want to talk to you about this case." And, he went through the whole thing and basically he's just telling me this story about this, you know, hard rock metal guitarist, Leo Schofield. Back in 1987, his wife disappears. Leo searching for her frantically for several days until they find her body in the water. And she's been stabbed to death. And, you know, he's telling me about this. He's telling me it's a typical wrongful conviction. You can see all the, you know, earmarks of a wrongful conviction. But then he says, "But there's something really interesting about this. 17 years after Leo was, you know, convicted of this crime, they found some fingerprints in the car that Michelle was driving when she disappeared. And they came back and matched to this killer who lived about a mile away from Leo. He's in prison for another murder that he's committed." And so all of a sudden you had this new evidence. And so when I heard that, I was like, all right, this is kind of interesting. And so he started walking me through the whole case and it takes place in the 80s in Florida. And, he said to me, the one thing he said to me, because I said, "Look, I don't know how long it's going to take me because I have a fellowship coming up. I have a book that I'm working on." And I could just feel his deflation in his voice. And he said, "Just do me a favor. Read the trial transcript. That's all I ask. Just read the trial transcript." And I said, "All right, I'll agree to do that." And it's, you know, it's 2,000 pages. And right. I figured I'll start reading, you know. And sure enough, like I got really hooked on this. I'm like, wait, this guy, these witnesses are all contradicting themselves. And then the prosecutor's tying it together as if they weren't contradicting themselves. And I kind of got hooked on it. And at that point, I said, you know what? I'm really interested. I want to know more.
Yeah. And so this was 1987, right?
Right, right.
In Florida. And it's, you've got 21-year-old Leo is married to 18-year-old Michelle. He's what, in band practice. She calls him on the from a payphone, says she's going to come pick him up and never shows up.
She never shows up. And it was like, you know, just a few miles away. So it was like, yeah. And once she'd called, Leo said, like, once she called, then I knew she was coming. She disappeared before and never made any phone calls. But in this particular instance, she did call and say, "I'll be right there." So they were expecting her in like 10 minutes or so. But then like a half hour passes, an hour, 2 hours, and they're starting to get really concerned now. And finally, Leo calls his dad and they go out searching. They're searching with friends for the next 3 days. They find her car. on the side of a highway, abandoned. And so what they do, once they find it on this highway, they work backwards from that spot, trying to go back to the restaurant where she worked. Mm-hmm. And that next morning, they find her body floating in this canal, about a mile and a half from you know, where the restaurant was, where she worked.
Yeah. And it's insane that the key piece of evidence all comes from an offhanded conversation that Leo's dad had with an off-duty officer, right?
You know, he talked to a couple different people. He had this premonition, he said. So when they broke up to search for the body after the car was found, they sort of separated and had different sections that they were all searching, and they would all meet in the middle. And at one point, Leo's father actually finds the body. And, you know, he flags down a truck. They get the police there. He's distraught. And he starts telling the story that God led him to the body, like he had a vision from God. Well, you know, he never said anything about this vision before, you know, because they were all together, right. You know, like they were splitting up places to go to. And it was, you know, a methodical search for 3 days. But after he finds the body, he makes this comment like, you know, God led me to the body and all this. And that guy ended up being used against Leo as like, well, this is the man who's responsible for your alibi. Like, what? How does it make sense that he actually found the body and he had this premonition? And they kind of spun it to make it sound like he had this premonition beforehand, when really it was just a story that he said afterwards.
Lots of places can accidentally expose you to identity theft. Doctor's offices, online retailers, insurance companies, the list goes on. Thankfully, LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. LifeLock keeps an eye on your personal information, credit applications, finances, and more. And if they find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, they alert you right away. All through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Even better, alerts are automatically activated the moment you become a LifeLock member. No extra work on your part. Get the alerts that could make all the difference. Don't wait. Join LifeLock now. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 30% your first year. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart for 30% off. Terms apply.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hola, déjame preguntarte algo. ¿Quieres que tu carro dure más, que corra más suave y que rinda mejor? Tranquilo, estoy hablando de tu motor. Te tengo algo bueno, Seafoam Motor Treatment. Seafoam ayuda a que tu motor funcione más suave y dure más tiempo. Y es facilito de usar. Solo lo echas en el tanque de gasolina y listo. Déjalo trabajar mientras manejas. Sin pasos extras ni visitas al mecánico. Si tu carro anda medio raro, temblando en el rally sin fuerza, gastando gasolina como cafecito por la ventanita, puede que sea hora. Seafoam es tu primer paso sencillo para recuperar ese rendimiento, para que rinda como debe ser, suave y con power. Y esto no es nuevo. Seafoam ha sido confiado por mecánicos por más de 75 años. ¡75 años! Eso es mucha confianza, mi gente. Y por eso, millones de conductores lo usan todos los días para mantener sus motores fuertes. Agarra una lata de Seafoam hoy en tu tienda de autopartes favorita y pa'lante con confianza.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
And it's mind-boggling that that's the thing. Because there's no evidence to convict Leo or even suggest that he had anything to do with it. In fact, he's the one that called 911, reported her missing.
Right.
There's all the evidence in the world to suggest that he's out looking for her, for his wife. He's getting upset that the police aren't finding his wife. Mm-hmm. And then they finally find him. And because his dad made this comment, they lock into him. He ends up getting convicted, and you hear all about the trial and all that stuff on the in the podcast. But then, as Gilbert mentioned earlier, so then they find out that they found this fingerprint in the car years before,
right?
And it was 17 years later they finally they run through an APHIS database or somehow or another they end up getting this hit from this guy named Jeremy Scott.
Yeah, and that's the fascinating part, because you know, I mean, this is the part of the podcast that's kind of strange when you think about it, but. You know, after Leo loses all his appeals, he settles in. He's in prison for like 5 or 6 years. And, you know, he's trying to make the most of himself. He gets his degree. He's got a job teaching in as a teacher's aide in the prison. And he meets a social worker who's a little bit older than him. You know, this tall blonde woman named Chrissy. And they actually fall in love in the prison. And they end up getting married. And they've been married for almost 30 years now. But she's the one who gets obsessed with Leo's case and starts going over this because, you know, Leo says, look, I'm innocent, but every inmate says that. I don't want to play any games with you. You can look into it yourself. I'm not going to try and convince you it. And she does look into it. And she starts doing what I did. She read the transcript and she starts finding evidence that was never tested, which is those fingerprints. And she ends up getting them tested through a friend in a law enforcement agency. And they come back and match this, you know, known killer who lived right down the street, basically, from where Leo and Michelle lived. And so this person is now connected to the crime. And this is Jeremy Scott.
Yeah. And the short version of that story is no one seemed to care. This guy's a convicted killer and was brought up on charges for murder prior to this. The prosecution did everything they could do to explain it away, basically saying, well, he found the car after it was abandoned or after she was murdered and just tried to steal the stereo out of it.
Right.
And it's so you wish that this is something that just happened in the 80s and 90s, but like I'm dealing with a case right now that we have something very similar. We just discovered throughout the working on this case that there were, again, very flimsy evidence convict these two teenagers. And then we find out that the victims, it's a crazy case where there's a triple homicide. Two people were murdered inside the house and the house burned down. So there's no evidence there. Ugh. The third victim was actually found burning in a wheelbarrow outside. Oh, well, we find out that there's DNA, at least two full profiles. It says on the bottom of the sheet, CODIS ready, like solid DNA profiles on her ankles. So we're like, well, there's your killer right there. Well, they tested it against the convicted. And people that they thought they could, and it doesn't match anybody that they have in, you know, that was connected to the case. And so they just let it go. Yeah. And they just said, oh, it must be transfer. And then people make the arguments. So as I was listening to your podcast, I'm literally having people make arguments about that evidence in our case about how, oh, well, you know, socks, she could have walked in somebody's living. She had just taken a shower and gotten dressed right before this. So she, you know, put on dirty. Well, you know, DNA can survive laundry. She could have walked somewhere. She could have. And it's the thing is exactly what happened with Jeremy Scott and Leo's case is you have people that have started with a conclusion that Leo's guilty, and then they're looking for ways to make evidence fit that theory and finding ways to explain anything away that doesn't fit. And it's maddening,
right,
to deal with it. You know, for, you know, in our case, it's this, you know, all the reasons why this DNA doesn't matter. And in Leo's case, it's all the reasons that this fingerprint doesn't matter because they've already set their mind on the conclusion. And it's like I said, it drives you absolutely insane. And I've posed the question to people in our case of, if you didn't know about this one thing that makes you think that these two guys are guilty, if that wasn't involved, if you were just starting from scratch and looked at the case and found this DNA, what would you think? Obviously, that's the killer.
Right.
Same thing with Leo's case.
Yeah.
If you didn't have the dad's premonition and the cops just were searching your car and, hey, we found a fingerprint in the car. Look, it's a violent offender who belongs to the fingerprint.
It has no other connection to the victim. No other reason for it to be there. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where the case goes. And that would have been the easiest conviction of this prosecutor's life because you could look at this guy and go, oh, you know, the same office tried him for a murder like a year and a half earlier, and right. he beat it. But they were absolutely yeah. convinced that he was the one. And so why did they never just take those fingerprints from that car and just sort of say, all right, back then there was no APHIS system, but let's right. compare it to like known violent offenders in the area. If you did sure. that, you know, this kid lived a mile away from where the car, you know, from where the body was found. It would have yeah. come right back. They knew about it. In fact, it was the same detectives that investigated. I think part of the problem you have in exactly what you were describing is the prosecutor who prosecuted Leo also prosecuted Jeremy Scott and tried to send him to the electric chair. So he's uh-huh. the one who has to make the decision, you know, about these fingerprints. And, you know, these fingerprints are going to screw up his conviction of Leo's case. And so, like, this is the exact wrong person to be, you know, closing the investigation yeah. on Jeremy Scott. Mm-hmm. He's invested in the case.
Yeah. And that's so it's so hard with wrongful conviction cases is once you get to that point, like I want to believe just so that I can sleep at night that if that DA knew those fingerprints matched Jeremy Scott a week after Michelle's body was found, that they would have went after Jeremy Scott.
Yeah. Right.
You want to believe that. And I do believe that. But when they've already gone through the process of telling everybody, no, we're right. And this is the guy, and you convict him, and then you take 17 years of his life away.
Yeah.
There's just something that happened. That, I mean, it's like some kind of sociopathy that's just like, I cannot admit that this could have been the killer because that means I made a mistake all those years ago. And I'm just,
right.
I'm willing to let this guy rot in prison.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, not for nothing, Jeremy Scott killed somebody else later.
Right, yeah,
exactly.
I mean, that's the thing about, you know, this tough on crime kind of environment. Like, well, you know, you think you're being tough on crime by leaving the one person in prison that you think may be guilty or whatever. But he's not. And so by leaving things as is, Jeremy Scott goes off to somebody else. And so that was a big part of our podcast, is just meeting all the people after they blew the conviction of Jeremy Scott in that 1985 murder, all the other people whose lives he damaged, you know, by sexually assaulting, by killing people, families of them, all these people that we talked to, it just ripples out this like wave of destruction. And, you know, I think about this, you know, and Jeremy Scott ended up confessing, you know, years after, because he thought he was, you know, going to get a deal from the prosecutor on some kind of parole thing, and that didn't happen. So he ended up saying, you know, like, all right, well, now I'm coming clean. That prosecutor lied to me. And he ended up confessing to this murder. Now, just think about this. You know, the normal, well, no, it's not normal, but one way that you see it is sometimes a prisoner will confess to a crime that he's committed. All right. So let's just say someone in a prison in North Florida says, by the way, I killed someone in 87. I never got caught for it. I got away with this murder. You know, the first thing the state's going to say is, well, that's great. Anybody can say that. Are you forensically tied to the crime scene? And in this case, Jeremy is. And so to me, it's like, it's kind of a no-brainer. You have a confession, someone who's confessed multiple times to this murder in detail, and he's also forensically tied to the crime scene, the same way he is in three other murders that he committed. So can we look at this and look at who Leo is and who Jeremy is and figure this out?
Yeah. And that was the most shocking thing was when, you know, that wasn't even enough to overturn the conviction. And I don't want to give too much more away than that because I want people to listen to it. But I'll say this, that his, I was still like, I'm not 100% sold on the confession until when he talked to you and Kelsey and you hear him and he gives gives some details that could not have possibly been known by anybody but the killer. And you just want to slam your head against the wall that poor Leo is still sitting in prison for this crime, while this guy, who's by all accounts not a good guy,
right. He
just, there's something about it where he's just like, okay, I'm willing to tell the truth about this thing. It's not going to affect him. He's in prison the whole time. He's not getting anything for it, but he gives the details that prove that he's the one that did this.
Yeah,
and Leo's still in prison. And it's completely tragic. Your storytelling and your reporting and the investigative work, both with you and Kelsey, is absolutely fantastic. And I'm gonna leave that right there so people can go check out the rest of it. His name is Gilbert King, and the podcast is called Bone Valley. The entire season, there's 9 episodes. They're all out. It just ended in November, so you can shut this off and just binge the whole thing, I highly recommend you do just that. Gilbert King and Bone Valley. Gilbert, thanks so much. It's an honor and a pleasure to meet you, and I appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to us.
Anytime. I had a really good time with you guys. This is a great show you have here, so thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Gilbert. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Siempre quiero que mi carro dure más y corra suave, sin estrés, sin rollos. Por eso uso Seafoam Motor Treatment. Es bien fácil de usar. Lo echas en el tanque de gasolina y listo. Sin herramientas, sin esperar. Seafoam ayuda a que el motor funcione más suave y dure más tiempo. Y sirve para lo que manejes. Carro, troca, tractor, gasolina o diésel. ¿Tiene motor? Seafoam te respalda. Millones de conductores lo usan todos los días para mantener su motor fuerte. Agarra tu lata hoy en tu tienda de autopartes favorita. Seafoam. Échalo y enciende el poder.